Welcome to the latest and belated edition of the Fringe Average Podcast with Jason Parks. I'm Mike Farron. This week's podcast brought to you by Intrepid Inspections, bringing the same high-level thought and processes to insurance inspections that Baseball Prospectus brings to baseball. Visit intrepidinspections.com for our BP subscriber special. Well, it's been almost 2 weeks since we've been able to do this. How are you? Everything all right? Busy as shit?
Busy as shit, but I am well. I have missed you, although we have been talking.
Yes, we
just
have.
Just want to let everybody know we have been talking, and we are going to work it out. Mike stepped outside of the marriage.
Yeah, I did.
Hang out with Kendall.
That was it. It was, you know, there's just something about a man with that much arm hair and love for condiments. That
he puts jalapenos on everything.
Let me tell you what. We go to – the first thing, I spent a week with Kendall Rogers, basically sitting next to him every day, right? We go
His
to
arms
dinner.
Look like Robin Williams' back.
It's not hair. It's ground cover. I mean, he
looks like a wild animal.
He's sitting at dinner. We're at this nice steakhouse, the Drover in Omaha, which is a great place, right? Mm-hmm. And I take a picture of him mixing his sweet tea because I have to do that, right? You have to take a picture of Kendall in his sweet tea. And he has in front of him, at a steakhouse, the biggest plate of ketchup you've ever seen. I mean, literally like half a bottle poured on it, right?
Yeah.
So I tweet the picture and everybody's giving him a hard time about the ketchup. 3 days later, we're sitting in the press box in Omaha and he gets a sloppy Joe and literally poured an entire bottle of mustard over top of the bun.
He has mustard. No taste. Wow.
God.
A&M.
He does take his class ring off to type, though.
I know.
It's just too heavy. It's just too heavy. I can't type with that on. Okay, well, then maybe you shouldn't wear it.
He should be taken out and shot.
I told him, I said, you know, the podcast, we make fun of you every week, right? And he was like, I just punched him in the gut. He was like, you do? His feelings were really hurt by it.
Good. I said, I don't want to hurt his feelings. I hope it hurts. I hope it's real. I mean all this.
I know you do.
But I love him like a brother.
Love him just the same.
Like a hairy brother that I don't want to talk to very often.
Coming up on the program today, the futures game rosters have been released, so it seems like a good idea to go over those.
Should probably touch on it.
Yeah. You also released your top 50 prospects list, your mid-season report.
I did.
We'll find out how that went in just a little while. And it's a very good list. I like the list.
Thank
very
you,
much.
Michael.
Somebody's got to have your back. And then we'll also talk about the College World Series because I was there and I saw some things that some guys are a little bit under the radar that I really liked, including a couple that I felt could move fast. But we'll talk about those guys as well. So our music this week on the podcast comes from Slow Warm Depth. Eric Loggenhagen from Crash Burn Alley, who's a good friend. It's his future brother-in-law's band. So thank you very much to those guys for letting us use their music from Slow Warm Depth. If you want to reach us, you can do so at our email address, fringeaverage@gmail.com. On Twitter, Jason is Professor Parks. I'm Mike Farron, SXM. And, of course, you can reach Mark at Fringe Average. And then our Facebook group is facebook.com/groups/Fringe Average Podcast. And if you're using iTunes to listen to this, please feel free to rate and review us. Onward and upward. You ready for some emails?
Yes, sir.
Dear Professor and Mike, before I begin, I ask my question, I'd just like to say I've extremely enjoyed the first 10 episodes of the Fringe Average Podcast. It's filled the void in my podcasting life that was left by Up and In, R.I.P. Kevin. I'm never really sure if the emailers write R.I.P. Kevin or you add it in there yourselves, but I'll write it anyway because it's fucking hilarious.
We don't add to the content. No, we do as little as possible.
We actually hope he doesn't rest in peace. Now then, on to my question. It seems like nowadays Tommy John surgery is extremely common. Well, at least more common than it used to be. I don't know if this is 100% true or not, so if it isn't true, well, then I guess you can stop reading. Over the past year, I've heard an interesting statement said a couple of times by a baseball commentator, I think Buck Martinez, but not completely sure, in reaction to hearing that a prospect is headed for Tommy John surgery. The statement being good, that he's getting it out of the way early. Is there any truth to that statement? I understand having a prospect go for Tommy John is better than having a major league contributor go for it, but do the chances of having a second Tommy John surgery actually go down after having the first one? Or is it just another case of a baseball commentator misinforming the masses? I know you guys aren't doctors, but you have better resources than I do to get this question answered. Again, loving the podcast. Cheers from Chris in London, Ontario, Canada. This comes on the day where it looks like Dylan Bundy is going to be heading to Tommy John surgery as well. He's going to go see Dr. James Andrews for a second opinion, and there's growing buzz around it that he's going to be having Tommy John and miss the next year.
You know what? I mean, I see this all the time, as you do too. Whenever a player is, you know, informed, or we're informed that the player is going to take the path of rest and recovery and not surgery, I always just assume that they're going to end up getting cut in a few months, and it just wastes fucking time. You know, the Bundy, I would have cut him 5 months ago. You know,
yeah, it's easy for you to say, it's not your elbow.
Yeah, I understand that, but I mean, how often does rest actually turn out to work?
Well,
how often does a young pitcher go see Dr. Andrews for an opinion, the first opinion, and then change course and then not have the surgery? When does that happen?
It does happen on occasion, and sometimes what will happen is it will push it a couple of years down the road. So, I mean, there's a couple of things that happen in this. One, guys will pitch with partial tears for years and years and years and years and years, though some surgeon may say, well, you know, and even Dr. Andrews say that this is an option for us, but let's try and rehab. The other part of it is that you know, now – over the last year or so, Dr. Andrews has tried to start using platelet-rich plasma treatments in an effort to try and heal ligaments or heal sprains. And he's had some success with it, at least when it comes to shoulders. It was a big in sticking in the Orioles organization. Zach Britton had a PRP at the end of spring training last year. And it was a big reason why he was able to pitch that season and why he's back in the big leagues now. Otherwise, he was looking at shoulder surgery, and God only knows how that turns out for him. So, I mean, I think that there is some to that, but I always think that, you know, well, it feels like that from the outside, and saying, oh, yeah, why, just get cut, get it done with, let's get it over with, let's get it move on. Surgery is a major fucking deal, and if there's any way you can avoid doing it, you're going to try and do that first. That's the conservative course of treatment, because what happens if it's the one time? Because it's not 100% recovery on the first Tommy John. It's, what, 85? What happens if you're Ryan Madsen? You know, Ryan Madsen hasn't thrown a pitch in 2 years.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate.
And that was on his first Tommy John surgery. You know, so, I mean, that's not even talking about the second one, which we can get into in a minute. But, I mean, I have no problem with these guys trying to rehab it before they get cut, because they're getting their fucking elbow sliced open.
No, I mean, I get that. I understand that. And I'm not trying to suggest that, you know, they need to rush into something. But, you know, I think that the younger they are, the more willing they should be to get cut. Go ahead and cut me and let's go, so I have this bright future ahead of me, instead of just delaying the process by 6 months or a year or 2 years.
I mean, if they didn't think that he needed surgery, and I talked to Orioles people going back to April, and they were convinced that he didn't need it.
Okay, I mean, I thought that before he went to Andrews, he was told that he needed surgery, and that's why he went to Andrews for the second opinion.
No, they went – this is – this last time, they were going to go to two doctors to double-check it.
Okay.
When he went in the spring, they did an MRI and everything looked fine. I mean, it was – I don't think the word was pristine, but Dan Duquette – basically said it was fine, that it was going to be rest and rehabilitation. And then when coming back, it, you know, he couldn't recover from it, and that's when he went to go see Andrews the first time, and that's when Andrews did the PRP. So, you know, again, you're looking at conservative forms of treatment where you're waiting to do surgery until the last possible minute. This is when he actually is being told. I mean, he hasn't been told it officially yet. It's just that's where the buzz is, is that he's going to Tommy John. But I think it's a – I don't want to say it's a ludicrous statement, but it's fairly odd to think that, you know, well, good, well, he's having surgery on his elbow, so he's going to be fine. I mean, you're usually okay for 5 years after the first Tommy John, but then you're at risk just like every other pitcher.
Right.
And that second Tommy John is almost a death sentence to your career. I mean, it's a less than 50% recovery rate. So it's if you have to do it two times or even three times. I think Chad Fox had three. That's a it starts the clock ticking a little bit faster on your career. It really does.
Yeah, I mean, it sucks that it's happening to Bundy, a guy who was, you know, such a promising such a promising young arm coming out of high school, and, you know, this also opens up the box where everybody can speculate about that one game where he threw 160 pitches or something like that, and that's the cause of this, or now high school coaches are evil and whatnot. I think it just opens up a lot. But when it specifically the surgery, yeah, I'm pro surgery. Cut him.
Are you saying it's okay for high school coaches to let pitchers throw 160 pitches?
Hell yeah. You know, I'm pro pitches.
I think it's ridiculous to suggest that one moment 2 years ago is what caused him to have Tommy John surgery now, though. You're talking about one game of fatigue that causes that? This really
depends on the pitcher and the situation.
I think this really chaps me about this, the whole way that pitcher abuse kind of gets quantified. And it certainly bothers me in the college game, you know, as somebody who follows that.
Sure.
You know, it's one thing to say, okay, a guy threw a lot of pitches in a start. But most teams are looking at over a 3-start span, you know, and you can't just take that one moment in a bubble and say this is good or this is bad. We heard it a lot with you know, and we'll get into the College World Series later, but Rodon started on 3 days rest. And everybody was blowing their minds up because he was starting. How dare they start the potential 1-1 pick the next year on 3 days rest? Now, he was coming off a 108-pitch complete game, and they had an 80-pitch limit on him. And you know what? He threw 80 pitches in that game. I mean, just back up, kids. Just take a deep breath. Everybody wants to jump to a conclusion too quickly, and you just can't do that. You can't do any of that in baseball. It pisses me off about media in general, as we all want to jump down somebody's throat to begin with, as opposed to letting the facts come in or actually trying to make an informed decision on something. It's irritating.
Well, I also think that people have a way of viewing baseball, and they want to push that on everybody else, that it needs to be universally accepted because you think that this is the way it should be. You think that college should be a farm system for farm systems, that's the way it should be, and I disagree with it. You know, and I'm okay with somebody who doesn't agree with, you know, the college model or the high school model, but I happen to be fine with it. I don't have a problem with college coaches trying to win college games.
How about high school coaches trying to win high school games?
I don't have a problem with that either.
I mean, you're competitors in the end, right?
You're a baseball player. It's a competition. You're out to win. Everybody else.
I mean, I understand a little bit from the high school standpoint because of the age of the competitors. You know what I mean? That you need to kind of be looking out for their best interest because they're so young. But I do think that it gets a little bit overblown with college, and I do think that for the vast majority of college coaches do have their players' best interest in mind. Not all of them, certainly, but the vast majority of them do.
You know, and I also hate this argument when people say, you know, and I'm going to be a hypocrite here, but I hate it when people say, well, you didn't play, you don't understand, because I think that, you know, there's a lot of the talent evaluators that I know in baseball, they didn't play baseball, you know, and they're still baseball people. But unfortunately, I do think that there are a lot of members of the media who never, you know, got to sit in the dugout. They never had that thrill of competition. They don't realize what it's like to be in that kind of moment. And, you know, it's obviously amplified at the College World Series. I mean, these are competitors, man, and they want to compete. Why are you trying to limit what they can do?
Well,
I like that.
I mean, the heart is in the right place, right? I mean, you're trying to protect someone from themselves, potentially, because, of course, the kid's going to say that he wants to go out and compete. I mean, I understand where it comes from, but I think there is something to it. I mean, listen, I didn't play baseball at a high level. I played 1 year of high school baseball, right? I mean, and I was shitty. I mean, I'm a no-hit first baseman, right? But I'm competitive. I want to compete. I understand what it takes to be competitive, and I don't think you necessarily have to have played to understand competition. I think that there are people who did and didn't play who are not competitive people that make those decisions and make those comments.
Yeah, I can see that. It's frustrating.
Our next email comes from Nick in Cincinnati. It says, Dear Professor and Matt, let me begin by saying how much I love the podcast and all of Matt's work on the Today Show. If you had a choice between a prospect that was solidly above average across the board but with no real standout tool, type A, and another prospect with plus or plus-plus tool or two and very little else, who would you choose? Similarly, if you were given a choice between a group of 10 type A players or 10 type B players, which group would you choose? A buddy and I were recently discussing the matter, and while we both agreed that we'd probably rather have the type A player because he'd have the higher probability of contributing at the big league level, we were split when it came to deciding which group we'd rather have. He said he'd rather have a group of type A players. I said I'd much rather have the group of type B players because while they'd individually be more likely to flame out, they would collectively be more likely to yield a true impact player. What say you? Thanks for reading, and keep up the solidly better than fringe average work, Nick in Cincinnati.
This is a great question. We had something like this on Up and In, and you know, we had a good debate that came from it. And you know, I mean, I kind of go back and forth because I like the high level tools. I don't think that playing it safe, I don't think that by getting, you know, roll four and roll five players is how you win, you know, rings. I think you need impact talent to win impact games. That said, you know, I think that you can make a case that a player that's solid average across the board is an impact talent because they can impact the game at the plate, at least on some level. They can impact the game in the field, at least on some level. They can impact the game on base, at least on some level, because they're at least average to solid average. I mean, when you get a player at the major league level who is a five or above at everything, I mean, that's a pretty fucking good player. You know, that's a player that probably plays up a role just because of their solid average at everything, and as opposed to a player that has a couple impact tools but is deficient in other skills. So, I mean, honestly, I'd probably rather have the team full of roll fives than a team full of just a few impact players.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's important to put in this, too, and just because Nick worded it this way in the email. You know, if these guys are all above-average tools across the board, if you're putting a 55 on most of the tools, I mean, those are roll six players. Those are first-division starters across the board.
Yeah.
There is a difference between, you know, here I'll just use power for an example, right? A five power guy is a 15 to 18 homer guy. A guy who's a 55 power guy is a 20-plus homer bat. And that's a significant difference. I mean, when you start talking about the difference between, you know, the tools, you're talking about, what, one standard deviation. Even those half levels make a significant difference. So in this, it's a no-brainer for me. You know, if we're talking about guys that are closer to average, I mean, if they're, or even if they have, you know, you know, say, you know, five average tools, just right at 50, it makes it a little bit more difficult. But the problem is that it's exactly what Nick brought up. It's the boom and bust part of it. Now, if you're talking about guys in A-ball as opposed to what you're going to have at the major league level, I think it's a much more interesting discussion because I almost would be willing to bet on the tools guys in trying to develop those to see if you have some sort of an impact than I would be on that type A group that's all just kind of, you know, even guys, if they're all kind of project to be able to have, you know, fives across the board.
Yeah, absolutely. I can definitely see that. I mean, you take a guy that has impact tools, you hope that you can take some of the tools that are deficient or below average and try to get those to play up just a little bit, you know, through player development. If a guy is just, you know, average, a solid average, I mean, you look at him if he becomes a major leaguer. You look at a guy who's just, let's say, average, just five. You know, this is a guy who's going to hit 260, 265, 10, 15 bombs, maybe 5 to 10 steals. I mean, that's a hell of a player, especially when you can throw in like 5 glove, 5 arm, you know. So, that I mean, that's a really good player. But if you can get a guy who, you know, let's say you can have a little bit more impact potential, like maybe a 280, 290 type of hitter, maybe 20 bombs, 25 bombs, even if they're deficient in other areas, I mean, that player is going to have more impact than just your standard roll 5 type. And at the lower levels, yeah, you definitely take the guys with the impact potential because you hope that you can pull up some of their other tools, or at least those tools will play up a little bit, and that the other tools will have such impact that it won't matter anyway.
And I think it matters, too. I mean, if we're talking about hitters here, you know, if you're going to put sixers or sevens on the hit and power, if those are the two tools that they're going to have,
they'll play.
I'm going to take that group over the five guys, because I'll take the guy who's the 300 hitter with 35 homer power every day, regardless of whether or not he can play defense. If he's a slug, you know, I'll find a spot for him in the lineup. Or I'll hold on to that guy because I can trade him for whatever I need.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you.
It's a great question, Nick. Thank you very much. Next, from Cody in Minneapolis. By the way, I just watched Neil Walker hit a two-run homer off of Felix Hernandez. Pirates are fun. Dear Jason and Marky Mark and the Funky Bunch, My question revolves around 2014 draft prospect Carlos Rodon. As a Brewers fan, it pains me to see a former 16th round pick turned into an ace at North Carolina State and bolt into the discussion for number one next June. How often does something like this happen? I know players move up in the draft from 1 year to the next, but how about a skyrocketing leap like Rodon? Mike, Mark, what's your take on Rodon since you were witnessing him at the College World Series? Jason, what's your thought on signability? Would you take a top-tier talent knowing what is unlikely to convince him to sign on the dotted line? Thanks for the podcast weekly. It almost makes me forget the fedora of Kevin Goldstein, Cody from Minneapolis.
I think it's quite common, but I'll let you talk about what you saw at the College World Series, but I think it's quite common for kids that come out of high school that either have strong college commitments or haven't progressed enough to get picked higher to go to in those 3 years in college or 2 years in college to take steps forward to become, you know, 1-1 type of guys. I mean, just look back at all the college arms who were taken in the first round of the draft and when they were first drafted in high school. I mean, most of them were taken in high school in later rounds and just didn't sign for a number of reasons, mostly because of either college commitments or just, you know, skill sets that didn't warrant a lot of money.
Well, and I think, too, I mean, remember, Rodon comes under the old draft system. So, you know, with the changes in the CBA, you know, when Rodon was picked, they could have offered him, you know, an arm and a leg to sign at 16. But there was probably a significant amount of risk involved. And they had a budget like everybody else, and they weren't willing to bust it in order for the risk that was Carlos Rodon at that point. I mean, he may not have been seen the same way coming out of high school as he was in college. I mean, heck, you know, like in the College World Series, there was a freshman, Alex Bregman, who's the shortstop at LSU, who was a pretty good prospect coming out of New Mexico, broke his hand and ended up being an eighth rounder and went to school. You know, so, I mean, he wasn't seen the same way coming out of high school as he was going to LSU. He gets on the field and all the tools start to play up. He matures. And, you know, this guy was the college freshman of the year. I mean, he was outstanding. So there's some of that to it, too. Now, as for Rodon in person. Oh, man.
Big.
He started two games against his arch rivals in North Carolina. North Carolina State played twice in Omaha. And the first game against them, he was 1-3 lifetime coming into that game, too, despite the fact that he hadn't, like, every run that he'd allowed to North Carolina in four career starts was an inherited runner that was allowed to score. Rodon just shoved. I mean, absolutely shoved for the first eight innings. He gave up two in the ninth. But he was, I mean, magnificent. 94 to 96 with the fastball. Just a wipeout slider. And he could throw it to lefties and righties. He only threw the changeup a few times, and it wasn't pretty. I've only seen him out twice in person, so I can't really, I don't know what he's got for a changeup. I know he throws it, but I didn't see it. But this is the most interesting point to me. But he's with CJ Nitkowski, who does stuff with our channel and does stuff with MLB.com. And he was there doing some video work with a bunch of the pitchers on pitch grips, right, on what the grips of the draftees or high draftees were using. And he talked to Rodon, and Rodon said, yeah, you know, I don't use my four-seamer at all because it just keeps going up and out of the strike zone, and I can't use it. He said, I'm only throwing a sinker.
Wow.
He's only throwing a two-seamer.
Nice.
CJ tells me the story that he looks at me and goes, that's going to change. I just burst out laughing. There's something else that's in there from this kid. I would sign him 1-1 right now. Yeah, I'd sign him 1-1 right now. Right now. Sign me up. You told me he was going to get hurt next year. I'd take him 1-1. I think because on top of it, man, he's got – I mean, he pitches with rig. I mean, he is a bulldog. He goes after guys. I absolutely love him. Love Rodon.
I was asked this in my chat yesterday – you know, if he were to be if he was available in the 2013 draft, where would he go? And I said 1-1. You know, I think that he has. You know, that this is kind of weird, but you know those characteristics that I was talking about that maybe I doubted Appel has. Everything I hear about this kid, he has them and more. You know, he's got that, as you said, that, you know, he pitches with rig. You know, he attacks hitters. He's not afraid. He's just. I mean, I can't wait to see this guy on the professional level.
Oh, well, you got to try and get down to Raleigh to go see him next year, too.
Yes.
I'll tell you what, well, we'll get more on the College World Series guy, but their shortstop's pretty good, too, in Trey Turner at NC State. I mean, he's going to be a high pick. I wonder, I mean, going back, if you were to put him, he would have gone number one in this draft.
You know, don't you think so?
Yeah, absolutely. I absolutely think he would have gone number one. Would he have gone number one last year had he been eligible? I think he would have.
Maybe, man. Maybe.
I mean, I think he would have gone over Correa.
I mean, it's kind of hard to look back now because we see what Buxton's become, and it's like, man, how can you not take Buxton?
Man, I might have taken him over Cole.
Wow.
I mean, if he were a college junior that year, because he's doing what Cole does. It's a tick less velocity, but man, it's from the left side.
Yeah, and it's more rig.
Cole knows how to pitch. Way more than I thought he was going to know how to pitch.
That's going to help him a lot. He's matured a lot.
Definitely. But now, Rodon is, he's special.
He's your guy.
Yeah, so. All right, our next email is from Joe in Pittsburgh. This is a long one, but so stick with me on it. Here we go. I will skip the usual pleasantries because I think I already revealed too much of my previous email about my girlfriend practically shitting her pants in front of me. You'll be happy to know she was appalled that I would share the story with the podcast listening world. Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. I'm glad to hear that. You gentlemen discussed Garrett Cole's lack of strikeouts in the last episode, and I have to admit I'm a little curious by it. He obviously has the stuff, and I loved Mike's quote that he has the stuff of someone who shouldn't know how to pitch, but he does. I know it's only two starts. It isn't much of a concern for now because he will get hitters out due to location command alone, but it somewhat concerns me that he embraces the lack of swing and misses. Makes me wonder if he will develop into the Verlander comp I hear so much about. Pitching is about getting outs, pure and simple, much like how basketball is about getting buckets and college is about getting laid. And I read a quote recently of a player saying that it was such a great line.
This guy needs to be on the show, I think.
And I read a quote recently of a player saying that a well-placed heavy fastball is the hardest pitch to hit in baseball. But isn't the ability to miss bats one of, if not the most important qualities of an ace pitcher that he can have in his repertoire? That doesn't seem to be a new trend with him either, as his reputation in college and the minors was a pitch-to-contact type pitcher who Scott said would get hit harder than someone with his type of stuff should. Maybe this just means he will be a damn good pitcher, but not the future ace that could bolster rotation for years. I think hitting has a significant amount of luck involved. You can saw someone off with a nasty 99-mile-an-hour two-seamer at the hands, completely shatter his bat, have it bloop into the outfield for a single. I was never good at math, but it seems like a simple equation. More balls put in play equals more chances for a bases-loaded worm burner off the bat of Yunesky Betancourt to find a hole and raise his ERA. Cole may never have a sub-2 ERA for this reason, so I guess this all depends on what you consider a staff ace. These are a lot of assumptions based on limited sample size, for sure, and I'm not even sure this email contains a specific question, but I think it's a fascinating case study of a pitcher's ability to get outs. Thanks, as always, and keep up the awesome work. Joe from Pittsburgh. And I think it's well worth discussing, Jason, with Cole, and what constitutes an ace? I mean, what constitutes an ace in terms of being able to have swing and miss ability?
I mean, look, ace is about production. And, I think that to sit atop a rotation, to find that sort of success, sustainable success at the highest level, I think he is going to have to miss bats. But I don't actually see that as being a problem for him. I mean, let's take it in sections. I mean, you have the stuff, you have the size, you have the delivery, and then you have the pitchability, which is, he's taken a lot of steps forward in that from just being like the thrower that he was when he was in high school to the pitcher that he started to become when he was in college, and then the pro pitcher that he started to become in the minors through a very specific developmental program that featured a lot of heavy fastball usage. They didn't take the training wheels off until, later on in the process. I mean, he was a very four-seam heavy type early on. So I think that when you put all those pieces together, especially with the pitchability, that I think that he is going to learn at the major league level what he needs to do to get outs. And I think that with that will come strikeouts. I think that he has to learn how to strike guys out. I do not think that he is a natural strikeout type of pitcher. There are guys who are just natural strikeout pitchers. They know how to go for the throat early. This is what they do. They go for the K. Some of those pitchers run into a lot of trouble. They end up getting in high pitch counts. They end up walking a lot of guys. I think that Garrett Cole is going to be the type of pitcher that's going to have to learn how to miss bats as opposed to just naturally being able to miss bats with quality stuff. I mean, obviously he has high-end stuff, but I don't have a problem with him being efficient either. If he can use that stuff to get outs, that's the most important thing. But I do think that in order to be an ace, he is going to have to – or to be that Verlander comp, which I don't really agree with given how he is – he is going to have to miss more bats than he's missing now.
Let me give you two other names who the stuff may not be right at least in terms of comparison, but I think that are probably better matches for the way he pitches, Jordan Zimmermann and Johnny Cueto.
I like the Zimmermann quote or the comp more than anyone. I think that they are very similar.
Zimmermann, the thing that and I'm about ready to go see him tonight, which is the thing that's great about him is that he has the stuff to be able to get a strikeout when he needs it. Mm-hmm. But he's a very efficient pitcher. And I think it goes to a lot of it has to do with the fact that he can command his fastball so well. And, you know, you mentioned with Cole, almost 75%, more than 75% of his pitches so far at the big league level have been fastballs. That's a ridiculous amount. You know, he's used the slider very little. He's used the curveball some. He's rarely used the changeup, although I think he used it twice in his last start against the Angels. So, you know, that secondary stuff is what ends up giving you the swings and misses. And, you know, his swinging strike rate, while it's below average, isn't, you know, terribly, you know, when you consider it's been three starts. I mean, I think the average is about 9%, and he's about 8.5% of his pitches get swinging strikes. So it's not awful in that regard either. It doesn't necessarily manifest itself in strikeouts, but he is getting swings and misses now and again. You'd like to see that tick up eventually. But I think that there are different ways to see a guy who's an ace if he can, you know, maintain a strikeout rate that's in, you know, the 6.5-7 range as opposed to one an inning and still give you a ton of innings. And I think that's the other part. You know, the one thing that keeps Zimmermann out of that discussion really for that level, Cueto for that level, is that they haven't been able to go 220 in a season. And Cole has the frame that makes you think he can be a guy that, as long as he's healthy, can give you 220 innings consecutive years, year after year after year after year in his prime. And I think that that's one of those things that kind of gets lost in that discussion. I think if you were to talk to most baseball people, most scouts, most front office types, they would say that innings pitch is a huge component for what makes an ace.
I absolutely agree with you, and that needs to be repeated over and over again. I mean, this is one of the reasons like a guy like Josh Johnson isn't an ace.
Right.
You know, I mean, the ability to go out there and get 220 plus, you know, to save your pen, to every fifth day, you're going to go out there and you're going to log innings. That's one of the biggest components of what makes up an ace. You know, the ability to year after year hold those innings. I mean, a lot of people didn't think that, you know, a guy like James Shields,
he's a one,
would deserve the distinction of being an ace. But I mean, what he does is go out and give you all those innings mm-hmm. every year at a high level. That's one,
and he's got you. It's that he doesn't have a plus fastball, but he's got a plus changeup. I mean, he has that change. He has a pitch.
It's a great changeup.
And he can throw it in any count. I mean, he can throw it in. He could live just on his changeup probably and be fine mm-hmm. yeah, because he gets such good movement on it. You know, I think it's a great name to bring into it. And I think that what you're seeing with, you know, with Kansas City's rotation in adding Shields in is, and again, this gets into the more touchy-feely aspect of it, the less quantifiable, but it really sets a rotation up because Shields, you know, is going to go 7 or 8, right? So the next day, that takes a little bit of pressure of how much the next guy needs to go deep into games. It also allows you to use your bullpen more with your 4 and 5 guys, knowing that they're going to get a break when the number one is on the hill, or more of a break when the number one is on the hill. And I think that there's a lot that kind of goes into that's very difficult to try and quantify when you have that guy that gives you, you know, basically a quarter of your innings total from what you're going to get out of your starters over the course of a season, what it does to help everybody else along the way because of the way it allows you to deploy your bullpen and the way it allows your other starters to worry about what they have to get done.
Yes, very underrated aspect there.
Our next email comes from Dave, and it says, Mark and Jason, feel free to paraphrase me. In the past, it has seemed to me that groups outside baseball, especially with what we call a progressive approach to baseball statistics, had a better grasp on player value than many people within the industry, and definitely what would be called conventional wisdom in baseball. You can debate that if you want, but my real question is this. The advantage, real or perceived, that groups like BP et al. Have had over the conventional wisdom was that they had better data because they were using some as opposed to none and better people to interpret the information. However, it seems that for the most part, this isn't the case anymore. Not only are teams looking at the same stuff BP is looking at with hit FX and field FX, plus God knows what other NSA-level analysis they're doing, biometrics, diet, and moon cycles, they actually have much more data than we can access. Does the outside community have to admit that the teams know much more than anyone outside possibly could? Shouldn't that be factored in when criticizing or lauding any decision, lineup, or free agent move? However, we can't use ignorance as an excuse to be afraid to evaluate as fans or hardworking gentlemen like yourselves. The follow-up question is what we learn all of these things about statistics and individual players in development, and we don't create a better game. Does knowing all this stuff even create better baseball, more money, more fan interest, or better game-to-game outcomes? Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. Thanks for all your want. Dave.
It's interesting. I mean, this is something that we talk about a lot and I think mm-hmm. about a lot. I mean, I don't think the deeper I dig into baseball, the more, you know, sources I get, the more I'm privileged to be able to talk to some of these people and learn, the more I realize how little I know mm-hmm. and how little we know. And by we, I mean people on the outside of the game. People inside the game are working with, even from the scouting side to the stat side, they're working with information that we do not have. They are more informed about the decisions they are making than the people who are second-guessing them for the decisions they are making. Now, it is our right to second-guess the decisions they are making because we're using that based on results. You know, it's a results-driven industry. And if a team isn't successful, well, then we look at their process because the process must be faulty, which I think is faulty. You know, I think that even the worst teams in the league are, you know, trying to utilize information that we simply do not have access to. So we do not have the complete picture of how a baseball organization is run, put together, you know, or functions. And I think that what we do know, we're free to criticize, we're free to critique. I think that's a healthy part of the process. But simply put, we do not have access. We do not have enough access to present or to come to the conclusions that are full.
Well, I would say that you're hoping to be full. I mean, hopefully organizations are making the best use of this data. This shouldn't discount what people outside of baseball can do from a research standpoint.
No, absolutely not.
And I think, even when we were in Seattle, they talked about that at the event, that they can consistently read Baseball Prospectus, Beyond the Box Score, Fan Graphs, as places to try and find new ideas, new discussion points. It's another voice in the room, and the public forum is still important for that. But I agree with you. I mean, I think that we are limited in what information we have available to us. I think that's why, actually having the kind of scouting service that you guys have created, with your group is really beneficial from a public standpoint, because what we should be doing as a public who are interested in the numbers and how the numbers have changed the way we've watched the game is now seeing how it matches up against the scouting reports. We can do that. It makes us smarter fans. It doesn't necessarily make us better than the people that are in front offices, but it makes us better. It gives us a better understanding of why decisions are made when they're made and why we might disagree with it without just saying, GMX is an asshole because he doesn't look at the things the way I do. And I think that's one of the things that's kind of still important in this. Does this make a better game? Does all of the research, do you think, has it made a better game of baseball?
Yes, it has. It's made it a more competitive game. Absolutely.
I'm trying to think. I mean, I love the information and I love the access. The problem is, like, for me, it's difficult to detach from the romanticism of, like, baseball in the 80s. Like, when I was a kid and baseball was just awesome because it was baseball, as opposed to being awesome because I get to, work on the peripheries of it.
Or just the shell of baseball itself, the game itself. I mean, the fundamentals of the game itself. Like, the more detail-oriented you become, the more specific you get with the game, you start to lose some of the overall picture.
I just wonder if it's – I mean, I don't know if it's better or worse so much as it's just different. You know what I mean? And I'm okay with that. Like, if it's not better, if the game isn't better today or better understood or any of that, it's just a different way of looking at it. I definitely think fans are smarter.
Fans are smarter and front offices are smarter
yes.
and scouts are smarter. Everybody in the game who's working in the game is smarter, and I think that makes a better product. I mean, when the first team decided to go outside of the box and, hire more scouts, hire, dedicated people to work on stats, dedicated people to work on pitch FX, dedicated people to work on, framing, dedicated people to work on field effects. When one organization steps out to do that and the rest follow suit, the game progresses.
Okay. I can see that. That's a good way to look at it. I like that. So, Dave, great question. Thank you very much. Next comes from Jeff in Minneapolis. Dear Jason and the other guy, just joking, Mike, I always like the way you use the F-bomb. Fuck yeah. I'm a lifelong baseball fan. I played my fair share and watched a ton. I'd like to think I have somewhat of a clue as to who is good and who is not good when watching a game, just not to the ability of guys like you. I just attended a game in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, between the Colonels and the Peoria Chiefs. I'm from Minnesota and really went down there to check out Mr. Buxton play. But as the game is being played, my buddy and I were thinking realistically, not only what other guys in this game will ever see the majors, but who will even have a shot at the majors, and who are just guys that are to play and really have no hope. Looking at the roster, most of the guys are in the 22 to 24 range age-wise, and a handful being between 19 and 21. So it's not like they're all fresh from high school or just getting started. But aside from Buxton, looking at position guys like Adam Brett Walker, Dalton Hicks, J.D. Williams from the Colonels, and guys like Patrick Wisdom, Nick Martini, and Jeremy Schaefer from the Chiefs, just to name a few. Are these guys just hoping to make it someday, or are they guys on a real path with a real plan? I would say that Hicks, even though he was over on the day, and Wisdom were the only two guys that stood out. Wisdom hit a bomb to left that's still going up. I will tell you, though, Buxton reminded me a lot of B.J. Upton as far as his stature goes. And at this time, I was thinking, you know, if he turns out to be B.J. Upton, it'd be a semi-disappointment, but wouldn't be overly terrible, as B.J.'s a pretty good baseball talent. But then I listened to Jason on the 411 podcast from Friday and heard him say, floor is Torrey Hunter and ceiling is somewhere between Mike Trout and Willie Mays. That gave me one of those special feelings, like when I was at junior high dance as a 7th grader and I was dancing with a 9th grader. As far as Buxton goes, he didn't do anything spectacular, except he made this catch in center where he was positioned towards left center with blooper over the second baseman's head. And as it's in the air, I'm thinking it's a hit, but I'm watching Buxton close on the ball, and it was amazing. He eventually made up enough ground, dove for it, caught it, got up, and that was it. No standing ovation from the crowd, no special high fives from his teammates, just another normal catch for him. But to a guy who doesn't watch him every day, it opened my eyes as to what he could do defensively. Thanks for taking the time to read this. I might be all over the place, but I'm still recovering from 20 hours in southeastern Iowa. Jeff in Minneapolis.
Yeah, that's actually a scout quote that I got. I was talking to him about Buxton. I was like, look, man, you sat on the series. What do you think? And he said, you know what? I think the floor, I mean, sure, something can happen. Injury could happen. But, like, the floor is probably somebody like Torrey Hunter, a guy who can really go get at it out in center. And, you know, the bat is good. The bat's just not, you know, superstar good, but it's good. You know, the bat's really, really good. You have a lot of all-star seasons. He's like, and I go, what about the ceiling? And he's like, dude, I don't know. Mike Trout, Willie Mays, I mean, what do you, you know, somebody who's a superstar. You know, you can put, he goes, it's not responsible. And he's like, I know that people will eat this up. And he's like, but that's what I put in my report, because what the fuck do I know? He's like, mm-hmm. It's going to be special if he hits the ceiling. It will not be normal.
I don't want to say that every single player in a ball feels like they're going to make the big leagues, but the vast majority of them do. I mean, some may see the writing
Buxton
on the wall
does.
Coming. Yeah, Buxton does. But I think anybody who's playing professional baseball has the dream of making it to the big leagues. I mean, that's why they're doing it. You know, they're not doing it and saying, well, you know, I've got a career maybe as a, you know, a roving hitting instructor if I can just play 3 years in A-ball. You know, I mean, everybody wants to make the big leagues. I mean, that's why you play, right? I mean, that's why you're doing this, is to try and get to the major leagues. It's a dream. It's something you get a chance to follow. And I don't think until you're really faced with your career, you know, being over, that you start to make other decisions. And even then, you can start to make other decisions, but still, you know, think that you're going to get there or get back. And, you know, nobody's playing the game to just say, I'm going to top out in Double A. They all want to get there, whether they're one of the best talents on the field or not. And some of those guys that, you know, are working their asses off to be bad as A ball players, you know, because they have the want, but they just don't have the skill.
Right. And I mean, a lot of these players, you know, I don't want to say that they're delusional, but what made them great in the first place? I mean, like, even the worst players that you're seeing on A ball lineups, I mean, they were probably the best player in their high school, maybe the best player at their college. They think that they're the best. They've probably been told that they're the best. They get to they get to professional baseball in the lower levels, and they start to realize that they're not the best. Mm-hmm. You know, but they're still competitive. They still have to think that they're the best. I mean, that's what made them get to that level in the first place. The fact that they're, you know, competitive lunatics. The fact that they eat and sleep baseball. I mean, you know, there comes a time, and it's usually in AAA, when you realize that you're not going to be who you think you're going to be, and you get really bitter and you become an asshole. But, you know, the whole point, even those guys in AAA are who they realize that they may not get a cup of coffee. You keep playing because you know what? You might get a cup of coffee.
Right.
And you don't want to give up before you get that chance. I mean, one of my best friends in the game, you know, played 12 years in the minors basically and never got that call. And I guarantee right now if he's given a chance to go pitch for another year, he'll probably go do it because you never know.
Right.
And that's why you play the game. You know, that's why even the bad players, I try not to be disrespectful, even like when I'm looking at their skill set, even if they're role three players, because, man, they're playing professional baseball and they're chasing something that we all kind of wanted to chase and never got as far as they did. So, man, I always tip my cap to them, even though they're bitter assholes in AAA.
Here's to AAA bitter assholes. Our final email comes from Matt. Says, Professor and Mike, fuck this name game nonsense. As a Matt that has been often confused with a Mike, it's just awkward and irritating.
As it turns out, Matt?
No.
Mike?
Not on this side. It's not Matt. Can you please just talk about the Mets young pitchers for a bit? I don't have a clever email like most of your listeners with high baseball IQs. Yesterday featured a Matt Harvey, Zach Wheeler sweep of the Braves in Atlanta. I'm just interested to hear if you guys think the Mets' future is as bright as we've been promised. How about Rafael Montero? He doesn't have the pedigree of Harvey or Wheeler, but he's been pitching his balls off in the minors. In my opinion, your podcast is a great service to the game and has made me a better fan. Sorry for the choppy email. You might notice I'm sitting at a 4:50 a.m. Eastern time. I can't sleep. It's just been a great day. Oh, yeah, and Jeff Passan wrote a story about Wheeler that's inspired this rambling email. Finally, Harvey 80 Watt, right? Thanks, fellas. Matt. If you haven't read Jeff Passan's story on Matt Harvey challenging John Rausch to a fight after Rausch poured a bucket of ice over him while he was sleeping in the clubhouse, do it.
Also, don't read anything that Jeff Passan writes.
Yeah, well, I mean, outside of that, like those couple of sentences, that's fine. But other than that, screw Passan.
Just kind of pretend like he didn't write it, that another writer wrote it, and then enjoy it. And then once you realize that he wrote it, go, oh, man, really?
Passan's such a douche.
I hate him with all my heart.
Oh, me too. Me too.
But let's get back to this. I actually think I want to, like...
No, let's rip on Passan some more.
I wouldn't mind ripping on Passan. I think he's going to come to our little shindig and...
Oh, in New York? Oh, it's
yeah,
nice.
We can just punish him.
Boy, that's great. Is he going to take a horse carriage from Kansas City, seeing as he can't ever get on a fucking airplane to cover a game?
He'll probably be wearing recreational footwear.
Hey, man, I wear flip-flops, too. I live in Virginia. It's part of the douchebag attire.
Anyway, getting back to this question, you know, Montero's he's a really interesting arm. I think that he's probably going to be a bullpen arm, but I put a lot of pitchers like Montero into that box, and I'll admit I'm wrong when it happens, which it probably will happen because the Mets have a way of making me wrong. I think that the person that the pitcher that nobody's really talking about right now that they really need to when you're talking about like the Mets up and coming future is Noah Syndergaard.
Mm-hmm.
This guy is a motherfucker. He's a Texan, so I mean, I'm just going to get that out of the way so you don't think there's a bias here. This guy can shove, man. This guy's got tremendous size. He keeps getting better. His feel for pitching is there. He's got better command than a lot of pitchers his age, than a guy he's often compared to, and a guy he came from the Blue Jay system with, and Aaron Sanchez. I mean, this guy is the real deal. And I can see a trio of Harvey, Wheeler, and Syndergaard, and that's nasty. That's not fair. I mean, that's the kind of thing that pulls the Mets up. You know, I think that the Mets' future is very bright, and, you know, I'm not just trying to blow Depot here, but Paul DePodesta is a fucking talent.
Yeah.
You know, this guy is a talent evaluator. You know, I know he gets portrayed as being, you know, the dork in the room with the calculator or whatever. I don't know why I said calculator. With the computer. And a calculator. I'm sure he has a calculator on it.
He's probably got to divide, you know, hits by at bats or something like that.
Right. But the point is that this guy is a talent evaluator, man. This guy goes to the Latin American markets. He's in the amateur markets in the United States. This guy is a talent evaluator, and the Mets know what they're doing right now. The Mets have a lot of talent in their farm system, and I think they're making a lot of good decisions with that talent. The Mets are going to be good, man. The Mets are going to be a really good team, and I think that that trio of young arms could really be something for them. I really, really do. I really believe in Syndergaard. That's why I ranked him so high on the list.
Who do you if you're going to rank ceiling on those three, the Wheeler, Harvey, Syndergaard, is Harvey number one now?
Yeah,
ahead of Wheeler.
He is, yeah, because production's there. I mean, the thing is, you can't look past that. It'd be foolish to go back to the scouting reports that I had a year ago on Harvey and live by those. You gotta throw him out. A lot of people were wrong. I was wrong about him. I thought he was going to be like a 2-3 type of guy, and you know, I wasn't sold that he was going to be the pitcher he is now, but I was wrong, so fuck it. I think, yeah, he is a 1, and I think that Wheeler's going to be a 2 type, and I think Syndergaard could be a 2-3 type. So, I mean, that's a trio, shit, man. That's a core.
Yeah, that's really good, and if they could just add some outfield help.
Well, I mean, they have some young talent coming up, and it's not close, you know. But
they need something close. I mean, here's the thing: is that
I know they do.
Wheeler's in the big leagues now, so the clock starts ticking as far as I'm concerned on the rotation next year. Because even without Syndergaard there, Dylan G's turned into a pretty good pitcher. Jonathan Neese, I mean, now he's got the shoulder issue. You know, that's going to be something worth keeping an eye on. I mean, if he can rehab it and not have to have, you know, rotator cuff surgery, that's going to be, you know, maybe he can come back. I mean, he was a really solid kind of mid-rotation guy for them. They've got some pieces in that rotation, and they have a star player in David Wright. You know, if they can
David
add
White.
Where the fuck did that come from?
He's so white. He's too white.
He's surprisingly funny. Believe it or not, he's really funny. But he's you know, they've got just enough there that you go, boy, you know, I don't have to squint very far to think, or very hard to think, that this team has a chance to be good in the not-too-distant future. They need some offense. I mean, that's what they need, is they need to find a way to add offensive players. They're going to have some money in the immediate future. I mean, you got to strike while the iron's hot, because if you got Harvey and Wheeler, the future is never guaranteed with pitching. Take advantage of it now, because I watched Wheeler last night, and he didn't have a good night, but you saw why he's going to be good. Harvey's magical. I love Matt Harvey.
He's good, and they have some pieces on the farm that I think that, you know, they could put together, even though they, you know, they can put together a competent package if they wanted to go out and strike now. I mean, they have some pieces down there that other teams would have interest in, you know, especially if the team wants to go young and prospect heavy. I think that they could make some moves. I mean, don't sleep on the Mets, man.
Absolutely. All right. And so rather than sleep on the Mets, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back. We're going to look at the College World Series, the Futures game rosters, and Jason's top 50 prospects. That's all still to come on the Fringe Average Podcast. Again, the music this week is from the soon-to-be brother-in-law of a friend of ours, which means that we don't know him. Slow, Warm Depth. Thanks again to Eric Longenhagen for passing the music along. The podcast this week brought to you by Intrepid Inspections, bringing the same high-level thought and processes to insurance inspections that Baseball Prospectus brings to baseball. Visit IntrepidInspections.com for our BP subscriber special. So, three big things that we've been involved in the last 2 weeks. You had your top 50 list that just came out the other day. I was at the College World Series for, I think I saw 9 games in 8 days, something like that.
Nice.
And and the Futures game, which you're going to be at.
Yes.
And I'm going to be doing the play-by-play for on SiriusXM with Jim Duquette. And I don't know if we can announce this or not, but Jim Bowden's going to be doing the game from a scout seat with us. Like giving us stuff in between the half innings, which is going to be really, really cool, because Bowden and Duquette both are awesome, but it's going to be really neat, the kind of different thing that I don't think you could do at any other event. But so we're going to be doing that, and that's coming up. But where do you want to start? Do you want to start with the top 50, or do you want to start with college stuff?
Let's start with college, because I mean, you know, that you were just there, it's fresh.
It's actually probably more stale than your top 50 at this point.
It's fresh.
it was cool. I mean, the College World Series is a bucket list
This was the first time you've been able to do it.
Second. I went last year, but I wasn't there for as long as I was this year. So, it was a great event. Saw some, great talent. Obviously, we talked about Rodon already. Saw Hunter Renfro up close. Got a man crush on Wes Ray, the first baseman from Mississippi State, who's just got a big meaty face and a mullet.
Love the meaty face.
I know you do, man. He's a total Z-dar, that's for sure. I mean, he's actually improving as a hitter, too. Smart kid. He had a chance to play football at Mississippi State, but turned it down to play baseball, too. There was a significant amount of really good talent there. I'll give you just some quick thoughts on guys that I saw. There was a left-hander from Louisville that came out of their pen, E.G., who was a 15th router of the Rangers. He's going to move fast. As a situational guy, he'll be up very quickly. Chad Girardeau from Mississippi State, who was one of kind of the stars of the postseason, as I don't know if he's going to be able to get righties out of the big league level, but he's like 88 to 90 from a low angle. And he's really – this is the thing. The one thing that drives me nuts about college isn't the bunting or anything like that. It's how slider-happy guys get. They get a lot of breaking ball. There's not a whole lot of – they don't pitch off their fastball as much as I'd like to see.
Yeah.
But he's got a pretty good breaking ball, and I think he could be a left-on-left guy too in the big league. So those were fun to see. The guy that the Astros got in the eighth round, I really, really like, Brian Holberton.
Mm-hmm.
The catcher from North Carolina who put good at-bats on left-handers, including Rodon, hit a big two-run homer off a lefty in one of the games in North Carolina, won in the tournament, and really had some success against left-handers. He's a really nice player. I wasn't as sold on Colin Moran, though, because I just think he's a little stiff, and I don't know that he's going to hit for power at the next level. Like, he may be a 300 hitter, but I'm not sure that he's going to be even a 50 power guy. I mean, again, it's tough for me to put grades on stuff, but I just didn't see it with him.
I've heard the same thing, man.
Have you?
Good hit tool. Not sold that the power is going to show up at the next level, but the people definitely like the his ability to make contact.
Yeah, I mean, he hits balls hard all over the place. I mean, and uses the whole field. Really nice swing. Not the most athletic guy, so you wonder if he can stay at third base, and then obviously he pushes across the diamond. But if he's a 300 plus hitter, a 320 hitter, and is able to get on base and is an 8 to 10 homer guy, does he have value as a third baseman in the big leagues?
Sure, I think so. I think especially if he's able to hit for a high average, get on base, utilize some power, have some extra base hit potential. Yeah, sure. If he's making hard contact, he can hit a lot of doubles.
Yeah, and I think he's going to do that. I think he can hit doubles. But I wasn't sure that I looked at him and saw, that's a guy that's, the number six overall pick. That was the one thing.
Or the 1-1 guy.
Right.
I
mean, he was in the mix for 1-1, right? So.
Yep, supposedly.
Nice bat. I mean, I liked Holberton's bat better than him. I think Holberton, if he stays at catcher, if he can hit lefties, that guy's got a chance because he's got real power. I mean, that guy could be a monster. But
that's interesting.
If not, I mean, he's at the very least, he's athletic enough, he's played a lot of outfield. He's at the very least, I think he's a big leaguer. I think he'll make the big leagues. He's at least a fourth outfielder. So,
good call.
So, Michael Conforto, who's a guy that's going to be picked high next year for Oregon State, was really impressive as well, left-handed hitting outfielder. And I'll tell you what, Indiana has some real talent. Kyle Schwarber, who's their catcher, that's a guy to keep an eye on. He's not a catcher, but he has power, good compact left-handed swing, can really drive the ball. Really, really liked him. They have a sophomore outfielder named Nolden, who I'm interested to see how much he's going to hit, but I think he could be a center fielder and kind of top of the order guy. Great arm, really runs well. They bet on tools. I think we talked about this in a previous podcast. They really look for tools at Indiana, and they've got a guy who I hope somebody gives him a tryout as a non-roster guy. I don't know if he's going to be able to hit professionally, but Justin Curitan, their center fielder, was the best outfielder we saw in the whole tournament, and boy, can he play the hell out of center field. That's a lot of outfield there. His batting average has gone down each of the last 3 years at Indiana, so I'm not sure that he can hit as a pro. But, boy, can he play the outfield. I mean, it's really, really fluid. Really, really nice.
Nice.
So, did you watch any of it on TV?
A little bit, here and there, but not a whole lot because I've been so underground with the prospect stuff.
Well, you missed out. Vandertig, who won the championship game mm-hmm. last night, too. That's another guy to watch with the Giants. He was a sixth rounder. The UCLA pitchers, man, they know how to pitch.
Savage, man.
Oh, dude, he's the man.
Coach Savage is the man.
Great,
nice guy, too.
Great man. Dude. Yeah, great dude. But Vandertig, you know, they made a big deal out of Adam Plutko, who was an 11th rounder of the Indians. Mm-hmm. Plutko doesn't have, you know, he's 86, 87 when he's working up in the zone. Vandertig can do it at 90, 91, 92. I think that guy could be a starter. I don't think he's going to be anything huge, but I think he could start in the big leagues at some point. I mean, he's going to have – he has four pitches he can throw for strikes, and he's going to need some refinement. But it's kind of a nice steal in the sixth round, I think. I think that guy's a nice pitcher, really nice pitcher too.
So. I really like the perspective of watching a guy carve up college, you know, at a high, high level in a very, very intense environment. And knowing that he probably isn't going to be much at the professional level,
yeah.
It's kind of always weird to think about.
Yeah, and that's the thing with Plutko. I got asked that question a lot when I was in Omaha because, you know, Plutko's a guy who's had great success at UCLA. I mean, he's been their Friday starter, and he's just not overpowering. He comes after guys. I mean, really goes after them, and he's aggressive. And you know what? He'll probably put up numbers that look really good till he gets to about double A, you know, and then it may back off on him a little bit. But I had a scout the other day who used to be a cross checker, he's a pro scout now, who texted me and said that he thought that college baseball was equivalent to double-A baseball in a lot of respects.
Oh. I agree with that.
Yeah, I told him, I said maybe, you know, you can see the high-end guys can move to double-A pretty quickly. But I think the lack of depth on the college rosters kind of shows that they wouldn't be as competitive against double-A. Maybe against A-ball, you would see some competition there, but I don't think maybe even high-A, but I don't think necessarily double-A.
I think that if you put a double-A team versus a college team, a good college team, the double-A team would sodomize them. Maybe that's not what he was suggesting, but if you were to do that, it would be sodomy.
I don't know. I mean, if you had a really good college pitcher as part of it, you could probably shut down the double-A lineup.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I'd still bet on double A.
No, I would too. I absolutely would. But I do think it's, you know, I think as fast as you see some guys move, you know, that there's
sure
that some guys can do that right now.
Every team has that sort of impact talent. I mean, maybe each team has what, one or two of those guys that might be able to move that fast. If that, double A is stacked with guys who belong in double A.
Right. Right. No, that's a good point. That's a good point. I just thought it was an interesting text from somebody on that. I didn't necessarily agree with them either, but thought it was interesting. So, all right, your top 50 list came out.
It did. Man, I'm glad it's done.
It was a lot of work. 2 weeks worth of, like, every day working 20-hour days.
Every day working the phones, every day reordering the list, every day going over notes, every day. Every day. I was on the phone all for basically 2 weeks straight. So regardless if you like the list, I mean, I put the work in. For it.
Okay, so at what point on the list, because I'm sure everybody's read it by now at baseballperspectives.com, and if you haven't, you really need to. At what point in the list did the switching spots after phone conversations start? 5, 6, 10? Because I can't imagine that the top 3 or 4 changed a whole lot.
The top 3 or 4 did not change much. I mean, I put out like a sketch, and I sent it to like the guys at Baseball Perspectives, and I sent it to a couple of sources and got some feedback, and then I kind of reordered the list. And it, you know, it's kind of my baby, so I was, you know, I was playing with it. And then I, you know, I would call people and be like, okay, what do you have on this guy? You know, what do you have on Eddie Butler? What do you have on? I mean, you have Lucas Sims in your coverage area, or you know, hey, did you see Kyle Crick's first start back after being healthy or whatever? And I start to kind of piece those reports together, and I, you know, I don't know how I do it sometimes. I mean, I don't have like a system, but once I get all the information, I just kind of force it to make sense to me. You know, I force an order. And this is not, you know, prospect lists are snapshots, and it's not like it's a high ceiling list. It's not an OFP list. It's not an acquire list either, which, you know, some teams are giving me shit about. These are the 50 guys in minor leagues that I would acquire right now if I ran an organization. Unfortunately, that's just not the way it is.
Right.
You know, and so there are decisions to be made with guys who are a little bit closer to the major leagues, who have impact potential, have a lot of value that I think gets, you know, people miss the value because everybody wants the hot new guy. And I bought into this too. I mean, Buxton's it's hard to justify somebody over Tavares because Tavares is a future batting champion type of guy. But I think Buxton's the best talent in baseball. He's the best talent in the minor league level. You know, so those guys didn't change. Lindor, Ford didn't really change. Archie Bradley is the top pitcher. Wasn't really much of a big deal, especially after guys like Wheeler and Cole were out. You know, Sano's a guy that you got to put in the top 10. Yelich is a top 10 guy. You know, Taiwan Walker's a top 10 guy. Tyon's a top 10 guy. I mean, then it gets a little bit muddy when you have, like, you know, guys like at 11, it's like Addison Russell and Polanco. And, you know, the big thing that, you know, I think threw some people is that I ranked Austin Hedges number 13 in baseball. And one of the reasons I did this is, first of all, if you've ever seen this kid play, you know that he's the best defensive player you've probably ever seen play at the minor league level. I've never seen a kid this good at defense at a premium position in the minors. And given the wave, you know, the trajectory at the major league level of, you know, trying to identify the best receivers, the best pitch framers, and the importance and the value that's being put on these players, I think it's going to be, you know, it's going to increase going forward. I think more teams are going to value catchers with this kind of skill set because I know pitchers fucking do. And I think Hedges has got a better bat than people realize. I mean, he's probably a 270 type of guy, maybe 10 to 15 bombs. But he's a tough out. He's a good situational hitter. He's an aware hitter. And he's a hitter that's probably going to be able to, you know, have some on-base skill because he has a really good feel for the strike zone. I mean, especially with the way he knows how pitchers work. You know, he's such a cerebral catcher. I have no problem putting him this high. I'd put him fucking higher. I think he's going to be an incredibly valuable player. I think he's an incredibly valuable player now.
Wow.
And I absolutely adore him.
What was the guy that I know you said on Twitter yesterday that the guy 12 months from now that you're going to regret not putting on the list was Clint Frazier. Who was the toughest guy to exclude for you right now?
I mean, the toughest guy to exclude was probably Frazier.
You know, out of all of those, out of Berrios and Heredia and Hanson and Barnes and everybody else that you listed.
Yeah, I mean, look, there was a lot of people in the mix, and I think that it's important to note that like those last 20 spots, there's probably 50 guys that there's a decent case for. You know, it's all about preference, and this is my preference. And the preference was helped by, you know, was definitely influenced by my sources as well as things that I've seen in person. You know, there's a couple of guys. I mean, you know, I love Miguel Almonte. I think that he's a guy that, you know, he certainly could have been in there. Kyle Crick is a monster. That's a guy that he's got a lot of good stuff. Alan Hansen's a guy you can put the bat to the ball. But I think Clint Frazier is a guy that, he has real, true impact potential. He's a total baseball guy. You know, he has Almora-like skills, although I don't think he's going to be that kind of center fielder, assuming he stays in center field. And even if he has to move to a corner, which I don't think is a given, he's going to be able to hit the baseball. He's going to be able to hit for power. He's going to be able to do a lot of things on a field that are going to make him a valuable prospect. And the only problem is putting a high school guy in the top 50 without any kind of professional record at the time was tough for me. It was hard for me to justify it. Now, I can do Appel and Gray. I think they have the track record at the collegiate level. I could have done Bryant. Bryant would have been a top 30 guy. I'd probably put Bryant in near the Appel range. But not being able to rank Frazier kind of burned me a little bit because this is a guy that, you know, he could be a top 50 guy come next offseason, and I'll be like, man, I should have ranked him, but I just didn't have the nuts to do it. I mean, I have the nuts to rank Hedges 13, but I didn't have the nuts to rank a high school kid without a professional record in the top 50. It was hard to justify for me.
Nut up.
I homered. Tried to nut up.
He homered in his first professional at bat, too.
Of course he did.
So whose inclusion on the list surprised you the most? Who was the one that you, when you put the whole thing down, you went, man, I never would have seen that coming, or I didn't see that coming, that this guy would be a top 50?
Well, I mean, this is another guy that drew some shit from people. Is not the industry, though. I got a lot of props from people in baseball about ranking 16-year-old Julio Urias in the top 50. I ranked him 41 in baseball. But a lot of people on the internet thought that I was foolish or buying into the shiny new toy or whatever, but I don't give a fuck what they think. I mean, the reason he was ranked on there is because he's, first of all, he's not 5'11", he's 6'1", all right? In every single start, he's worked 91 to 93, touched 95 in every single outing. He's It's got feel for a curveball, feel for a changeup. Can pitch backwards, can pitch forwards, can work the fastball north, south, east, west. So this is a guy who's 16 years old, 6'1", left-handed, and missing more than a bat an inning at a full season level. Yeah, he's in the top 50. You don't want to agree? Go fuck yourself. What do you want in a prospect? Would you like me to wait 2 years until he's the next big thing, or would you like me to rank him now based on what I'm hearing from people in the industry? I'm on the phone going, what do you think of this guy? Am I nuts? I just got a report that said this, and they're like, we have the same report. It's crazy. You know, I wish we had him. I wish we had him as a common statement that's being thrown around about this kid. It's like, Do you think he's top 50? It's like, well, you know, if he was in our org, this is where he would rank. It's like, well, that makes me think. I was hesitant about it just because he is a 16-year-old kid and he does have a small track record. But, man, this is like basically a high school sophomore. You know, and I had somebody in the game that said, look, I know how great Clayton Kershaw is, and I'm not trying to suggest that this kid is the next Kershaw or he's the next anybody. I'm just saying that if you, as great as Kershaw is, if you would have taken him when he was a high school sophomore and dropped him into the Midwest League, he wouldn't be doing this.
Wow.
And not many would. It's a special skill set. It's one of the things that I think separates like a guy like Raul Adalberto Mondesi, you know, being a 17-year-old kid, you know, and more than holding his own in the Sally at 17, playing a premium position. Man, the younger they are, if they're able to do that, it's special. It's something that I look for. It's something that my scouting mentor, you know, Don Welke with the Rangers taught me, that if you can see a young player succeeding at a high level, they have a special makeup and they have special talent. And those are the players that become impact players at the major league level, and it's never left me. You know, that sort of scouting philosophy has never left me, and that's why Urias is on the list, and I'm not apologetic about it.
So who's the guy on the list that you haven't seen in person that you're most looking forward to seeing?
let me pull this up.
You didn't have it in front of you. I figured it was like your wallpaper now. It's your baby. or have you already shunned it? It can never replace Rolf in your mind.
My doll.
Your son.
My son. I'm looking here. I've seen most of these players. Urias fits into that category most certainly, but I've seen Mondesi a ton. I want to see him more. I want to see him more. I tell you what, this is kind of an interesting guy. And a guy that I haven't been able to put enough eyes on is Jake Mariznick. He's kind of a polarizing guy in the sense that the opinions are very mixed. You know, you get guys who will tell you that this guy's a ball player. This guy's a roll six type of guy. He's going to be a lot better than you think. He's one of the better players in the minors. And then you get guys who are like, oh, man, you know, don't really love it in center. Don't really believe in the bat. Don't really know what he's going to be. You know, I want to sit on a series with this guy before he gets up to the major leagues because you know he's going to be a fast riser. You know he's going to be in that Marlins outfield pretty soon. So this is a guy that I really want to see because I think that he could be a guy that ends up being a much better major league player than he is a minor league prospect. Mm-hmm. You know, one of those type of guys. Another guy that I've been able to see, but like George Springer, this guy's a dude.
Yeah.
This guy's got incredible power. I mean, I think he might end up being like a better Chris Young. You know, not a ton of contact, got a lot of swing and miss, but he's going to be able to patrol center. He's going to be able to hit 25, maybe 30 bombs. This is a player. The Astros are going to start, you know, producing some players here pretty soon, and they fucking need them.
Yeah, well, it's a pretty good sign that he can stay in center because I think most of the thought was, well, he can move to right. He'll probably be a right fielder in the end, but the fact
he's a center fielder, man. This guy's a center fielder.
It's funny you mentioned Mariznick because I was talking to a scout the other day. We were texting back and forth, and I said, "You seen anything good lately?" And he said Mariznick. And he said that, you know, one of the problems with Mariznick was he had that funny, I don't know if you would call it a hitch or what, but where he did something funny with his hands. And I know in spring training, because I ended up having like Marlins 4 days in a row. I must never get to like sit on a team for 4 days in a row. That a lot of what he was doing in the cage was working to try and get rid of it. And he said his hands are very quick right now. He's got a better idea of how to handle the strike zone, working pitch counts, using the whole field, and driving the ball to all fields, and every time somebody says something positive, I go back to, I was talking to Tino Martinez, their hitting coach in spring training, and I asked him about Mariznick, and he says when he figures it out, he's going to be one of the best players ever. That was the way he said it. He's going to be one of the best players ever. Now, I'm not sure if Tino was, you know, guilty of some hyperbole there, but the people who love him really do love him.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, look, we ranked him 71 in the offseason 101, and I ranked him 40th on this list. And if he becomes a first-division player, then we're all going to be in the wrong for sleeping on a guy like this. And it's, you know, what I want to do is I'd like to go sit on a series and just watch him so I can, you know, at least say that I saw him at a good clip in the minors, so I'm not – so I'm at least more educated about it. I mean – you're going to miss on a lot of these. These rankings are so subjective, and it's really hard to, you know, I'm not really looking to be right or wrong here. I don't want, you know, people will always bring it up like, oh, you rank this guy low, and then you turn into that. It's like, well, you know, I understand that the process is hard. I don't have a problem saying when I was wrong. I'm going to be wrong on a lot of these.
Right.
You know, I do care about, you know, the guys that I'm right on, you know, and I want to know why I was right on those, and I want to learn why I was wrong on the others. And a guy like Mariznick is a perfect example of a guy that I'm probably going to be wrong on just because I was too soft on him.
Oh, that's – I think that's a great point. I don't think you were alone on that. I mean, it's if he turns into that. I mean, there's a chance that he could end up being exactly kind of where you have him ranked or, you know, what you thought he was going to be. So you should get down there to see Jacksonville, though, because they've got a lot of talent, and it's going to move quickly. He and Yelich aren't going to be there much longer. So
no, I need to. So,
which brings us to our final point of the day, which is that the Futures game rosters have been released for Sunday, July 14th at Citi Field in New York. And mid-afternoon game, 2 p.m. Eastern, you'll be able to hear the game on MLB Network Radio, if I can give the shameless plug. This will be the fourth year I've had a chance to do the play-by-play for this game, so, and that's always my favorite. And now it means that in addition to the podcast, we're going to have an hour-long conversation about each of these guys at some point this week. So now that Goldstein is dead, we might have to be 2 hours with you, so I'd like to spread it out before, but now I
trust
you.
I can give you the same information in 30 minutes.
You don't have to go out and have a rip.
I've actually seen these guys.
Oh. That's awesome. So they did something a little different this year in that they have a final vote. They're going to add a 26th member to each team. And I think that there are a couple of these guys that probably won't play in the game.
I don't think Tavares should.
Yeah, I don't think Tavares is going to. He went back on the disabled list yesterday, I think, at Memphis with the ankle problem, so, which is a bummer that we won't get to see Tavares again. But, you know, that – it happens, I guess.
Yeah, life sucks.
Yeah, it's awful. And I think that there's probably a couple of other guys that you could see. There's a chance that and I don't know if he'll be back in the minors, but Taylor Jordan, I think, may make a spot start for Washington on Saturday.
Yeah, I heard he was.
He's moving fast, though. I mean, he was just at Potomac.
I know.
Coming off Tommy John, so. So, you know, there's a couple of guys on here. But what interests you most?
Okay, two things interest me the most. The U.S. pitchers – and the world infielders. The U.S. pitchers listed on the roster are Biddle, Bradley, Butler, Crick, Jordan, Nelson, Renato, Syndergaard, Walker.
Guerrero.
And Guerrero, yeah. Rig. That's awesome, man.
Better than last year's, even though? I mean, last year had Bundy, had Cole, had Wheeler.
I mean, this is going to, as I wrote a little bit about this earlier today, but it hasn't come out yet. But like last year made me do some really different things to my body. This year just may cause like a wedding, some diaper work. Because, I mean, man, I think Bradley's the top pitcher in baseball. I mean, look, all these guys, Walker was a top 10 guy. Syndergaard is a you know, top 30 type of guy. Crick could have easily made the list. I mean, there's just so many arms there, and they get to throw to Austin Hedges. So, I mean, I'm not going to bitch there. But then what really stands out on the world side for me is that not the relief pitchers that they always bring or the future relief pitchers that end up being there, but their infield. Like, listen to this fucking infield. And it could be, you know, you could have Correa or Baez put on this as well. But, like, okay, Alcantara, Bogarts, Franco, Herrera, Lindor, Sano. That's fucking awesome. And, you know, guys like Archie Bradley and Syndergaard are going to get to throw to these guys at the plate. I mean, this is the best thing ever. How could you not get excited? This is minor league baseball. This is everything.
You know, and I think that the outfield is at least somewhat interesting for the world team too. I mean, I think it's a better lineup, better collection of lineup talent than they had last year. Their pitching was really bad last year on that world team. They had a lot of guys that were in A ball and kind of, you know, part of what they have to do is they try and get every organization has to be represented. You can't have more than, I think it's four. They never put more than three from a given team on a roster, but they try to represent as many countries as possible too, which ends up diluting the pool of the talent for the world team. But, you know, I'm looking forward
to it. Yeah, it's not a true all-star game. I mean, especially when each teammate has two representatives and you have to fill positional need, you know. It's not a true all-star game.
And so you've got Gregory Polanco, Jorge Soler, and I'm going Friday night. I'm going to go see Bowie, and I'm really looking forward to seeing Henry Urrutia because the things I've heard are pretty positive. I mean, I don't know that he's, you know, going to be a special player, but I mean, he's got a chance to be a decent one, and he either leads or second in the Eastern League in hitting since he joined the team, and he's probably on his way to Norfolk. In fact, hopefully he's not going to Norfolk before I get to see him. But I'm just kind of intrigued by him because that's like the Cuban guy that the Orioles have been all over. They were all over him for almost a year leading up to it, and nobody else was talking about the guy. And every time you had a conversation, they were like, yeah, Urrutia is okay. But they're international scout is the guy that signed Vlad. You know? I mean, you got Fred Ferreira there who really knows his shit. And if he's excited about the guy, I find him intriguing because I haven't seen him yet.
Yeah, the same. I wrote that when I was doing my notes for when I saw the roster. It said he's the guy that, you know, I haven't seen. I don't have a lot of reports on. And, you know, I can't wait to watch him hit in the cage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like that outfield. It's not. I actually think the U.S. outfield is a little bit more exciting, and here's why.
It's
have
got
an outfield.
Buxton.
You can have Yelich, Buxton, and Springer, and you've got, you know, two catalytic type of players in Hamilton and Jock Peterson coming off the bench. But Yelich, Buxton, and Springer in an outfield.
You think Peterson is a catalytic kind of player?
Yeah, I think he is. He's like a gamer type of guy. He's not a catalytic player in the same way that Billy Hamilton is with his legs, but he's a catalytic player in the sense of the energy he brings to a game, yeah.
I mean, I think I saw him in the Arizona Fall League at the Rising
Stars game. He's a grinder.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he's going to give you professional at-bats, and, you know, he's kind of a tweener, right? I mean, the defense isn't good enough for center, and the power's not good enough for a corner, but...
Yeah, but he's a player.
But he can
play. He's a baseball player.
Yeah. His dad played, right?
Yeah, he's going to be a baseball player. I don't know if it's a four, you know, a fourth outfielder, or if he's a second division left fielder, or, you know, if he just is better than people realize and becomes, you know, a first division type of player. But man, he's a baseball player. He's going to play Major League Baseball. You know, he's fun to watch. I like watching him a lot. I got to see him a couple times this spring. You know, I mean, but watching Buxton is going to be the highlight of this. I mean, I don't like really that. The infielders that the U.S. team's bringing is like, you know, Gallo is going to put on an impressive BP because he's a monster and he can hit a fucking ton. And that's cool. And Colton Wong's going to, you know, probably win the MVP just because he's such a little gamer and he's going to have three hits and two of them are going to be doubles. He's going to steal two bases. And, you know, Brad Miller's a gamer too. But, you know, Delano DeShields is kind of and, you know, Addison Russell's really the only guy on that list that just blows me away. You know, the only top tier type of guy. You know, and he's a lot of fun to watch, too. He's going to put on a more impressive BP than I think people are ready for. I don't think people realize what kind of power this guy has, especially to Oppo. I mean, this guy's got tons of Oppo power.
I'm looking forward to seeing him in person. I want to see Crone take batting practice, too. I mean, he was such a huge power hitter in college at Utah. I'm interested to see what's there. I don't know how the reports have been at AA on him, but, you know, that's a pretty thin system. I was a little bit surprised that they didn't go with Caleb Cowart there, just based on...
Or Lindsey.
Yeah. Yeah.
Lindsey's the better player out of those guys right now. I mean, he's the one who's squaring up baseballs.
You like Lindsey better than Cowart?
Yeah, right now I do. I mean, just the reports I'm getting on Lindsey are just like, you know, this kid's starting to his barrel on baseballs, you know, and he doesn't have a problem doing that at the same level. You know, I like him. I think he's going to be all right. I don't love him. I, you know, maybe a second division type of guy, but I like him. I know a scout called me last night and said he put a six on him.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, that's always cool. I mean, and look at their pitchers aren't, they're not bad. I don't want to, you know, say that they're bad. You know, they're not bad. I think most of them are probably going to end up as relievers, but like Miguel Almonte is a guy I've been hyping for a long time. I think people are finally going to get a look at why I've been hyping this kid. You know, I mean, he's probably going to work 93, 96, maybe 97. He's going to throw you a really good changeup. You're going to be impressed by it. You know, Rafael DePaul is a guy that nobody's really seen. He went to, you know, low A and did some dangerous things with the baseball, missed two bats an inning. You know, he's got a lively fastball. He's probably going to work at 95, 97. He's going to have a ton of life on him. Montero's going to have a lot of life on his ball, throw a good changeup. Romero can get it up there. Yordano Ventura, who was in last year's game in Kansas City, is going to dial it up to triples. You know, he's going to flash 100, 101, and it's going to look really scary. Because, and then, you know, and Noah's on the list.
Is he intriguing, isn't he? I mean,
people are
going to
go, is it the same Noah that used to be a prospect? And that's, like, yes, sir.
The biggest bonus in history for an international signing when they signed him, and he missed 2 years, two full seasons to injuries, or three full seasons almost.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, he's still born in September of 91, so this guy is still really young, you know, but, I mean, everybody remembers when he was 16 years old and whatnot, but, you know, I think it's good for him. I think it's, you know, this is a kid who didn't give it up. It's when you're that young and you have that kind of money, I think we've all seen players who get large bonuses who don't fly out of the gate, and they tend to, you know, not progress the same way anymore. You know, they've been paid. And, it kept going, you know, and he's had to deal with a lot of setbacks. And, you know, I think that this is really, really cool, even if he doesn't amount to anything.
Yeah.
And I'm looking forward to it, you know, and he's going to be able to dial it up. These guys, that the world pitchers are going to be able to dial it up, you know. I think most of them end up in the pen anyway, so that'll be exciting. I mean, and they get to throw to the legend, and they get to throw to Betancourt. And, you know, the legend's going to put on a big batting practice display. I mean, this kid's got a ton of raw. He'll strike out during the game, but he's got a ton of raw. This is exciting, man. I'm really, really excited about this. You can tell. I mean, this is everything for me in a year. I cannot fucking wait.
I can't either. I love it. I mean, it gives me a chance to, you know, I don't get to do games very often, and, you know, that's what I love to do more than anything. As much as I like talking baseball with you and having a baseball talk show, I just love being at the ballpark and doing games. So it's one of my favorite events, and it's just so much fun to see that talent on the field, and to watch them kind of react to being on a big league field like that is really cool. So let me get your pick on the final five on each. For the American team, Tyler Austin, Nick Castellanos, Garen Cecchini, Courtney Hawkins, or Brandon Nimmo are your choices. Remember, Austin was selected last year, and then he got hurt, right? I think is what – didn't he have, like, a spleen injury or something awful happened to him, like, right before the game? Or maybe it was a concussion. I can't remember what it was, but he ended up being selected but not playing, if I remember right.
Yeah, I mean, that sucks for him, but I'd go with Casty. You know, he was in the game last year. He really impressed me a lot last year. I think he's a fucking hell of a talent. I think he's a, you know, easy top 25 guy in baseball. I think he's going to end up being a really good major leaguer, and I'd put him on just because I like to watch him. What about you?
I think I would probably go with him, although I haven't seen Cecchini yet, and I would like to see him. My guess is Nimmo ends up winning because it's going to be at Citi Field, and Mets fans will be out in full force for it. So,
well, that would disappoint me.
You don't want to see Nimmo?
I've seen it. I'll see it again. It's not like I don't want to see it again. I'd like to see Casty a lot more, but I'll watch it. I mean, I've been down on him, so I'm open to have my mind changed, of course.
Right. And then on the world side, it looks like it's let's see, Javier Baez.
That's it.
Over Correa, Renato Nunez from Beloit, Ronald Odor from Myrtle Beach, and G-Man Choi for Jackson. It's Baez or bust. No Correa.
Hey, look. Correa is a hell of a prospect, and I think it's great. I want to watch Baez take BP, all right, because it's fucking awesome to watch him hit BP. He's got so much raw power. People don't even realize how much raw power he has. I mean, it's up there with Sano. It's up there with Gallo. I mean, he has got man power. And I like Ruggie Odor. I like Correa. I like those guys. But, I mean, it's Baez, and it's not close. You want the top talent, but you want you know, something fancy on the field. You want to see somebody do something that's not normal? Baez. What about you?
I want to see Baez.
Yeah.
I want to see Baez. I saw Correa a little bit in spring training and was impressed. I mean, it wouldn't crush me to have Correa on that team. I'm sure there'll probably be a couple of roster additions anyway. There usually are some changes along the way. But yeah, no, Baez is the guy that I would really like to see. I mean, I think this should give some Cub fans something really to get excited about in seeing Baez and Soler on the field, and then also Alcantara, who I haven't seen at all, but sounds like he's, you know, I mean, I don't know. He's not a 101 guy for you necessarily.
He is.
Is he?
Yeah, I think he would be a 101 guy just because, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, does he play shortstop for the Cubs? I don't know. I mean, he's got some – he makes some errors. He's got some problems with – you know, he plays a little fast too. He's got the skills. He just needs some refinement on defense. But, you know, he can stick, man. He can hit baseballs. He can hit fastballs. He knows how to stay back on breaking balls. He's got an idea of what he wants to do. You know, I think that he's a hell of a talent. I mean, I think the Cubs system has really taken big steps forward. I think that when Bryant signs, it's going to come down to it. But when Bryant signs, I think they have four guys in the top 30, 31 – you know, and then a couple other guys thrown into the mix for the 101. I mean, this is a very, very healthy farm system. And, you know, talent is talent. You can use that talent to go out and get whatever you need.
Yeah, and they're going to need to go get pitching because they've got a lot of hitters.
Yep.
And actually, it's not a bad way to go about it because hitting is its power, especially, is at such a premium right now. So it makes sense. So what are you going to do the rest of the week? What do you have planned other than just, like, crashing at some point from exhaustion?
No time to crash. Tomorrow morning I'm going to New Britain to sit on a four-game series between Reading and New Britain that features just tons of talent. I mean, there is tons of talent on that field, from Sano, Rosario, to Franco on the Phillies, Biddle. I mean, it's going to be just absolutely awesome.
And Biddle's pitching in the series for sure?
I have no idea. I haven't looked, and I don't want to look. I'm actually avoiding it. No, there's nothing better than walking into the press box to grab your roster sheets and seeing a matchup that just really tickles you.
Yeah.
I've been going to short season games every night. I walk into the press box and burst into tears.
I heard Boss Man Joe's going to go to one of those games with you, too.
Boss Man Joe is going to come up on Saturday to sit on a game, yeah.
That'll be fun. It's always fun to be around Joe, man. He's
great.
Awesome.
What are you going to do?
I'm going to go. Actually, I'm going to do a lot of baseball in the next 2 days. So I've got tickets. In fact, I got an extra if anybody wants to go with me for the Nationals game tonight against the Diamondbacks. And then I'm going to go tomorrow afternoon. They've got like a late afternoon start, and it's Corbin and Strasburg. So
nice.
I get Zimmerman tonight. I can see Corbin and Strasburg tomorrow. And then Friday, I'm going to go to Bowie to go see the Orioles and Nationals AA teams. And, you know, I'm going to see Aridia. What I'm most interested in is Eddie Gamboa's pitching for the Orioles, who, you know, has been a career double-A pitcher, but he's converting to a knuckleballer. And I had a and I want to see it because I've heard it's pretty good. And I had a scout tell me, yeah, you know, he was throwing the knuckleball, and when he buys in, it's going to be good. Oh, and he also can still throw 90.
We'll see. If you can throw 90, I don't know what it's going to do to his arm. Can you throw a knuckleball, then throw 90?
He was in one of the first starts, he was using a knuckler.
Damn, you would think that would just be an amazing combination.
That's like video game shit.
Yeah, that's I'd like to see that too. It just, without even really thinking about it, it seems like he's going to get hurt doing that. Maybe, I don't know.
I don't know.
That's not right, right?
I've seen Eddie Gamboa pitch a lot of games, and he's just like off the charts makeup guy, like really, really good org guy. But, you know, let's see if it works. I mean, he's trying to buy into it. You know, he's still, the thing is he can still see himself getting double A hitters out with, you know, he's 90 to 92, you know, and he's pretty good command. He just doesn't, secondary stuff isn't great. But I'm interested to see because he's got the makeup to make it happen. I mean, he's got the work ethic that he could do it. So, and he's at least got the beginnings of a feel for it. So I'm kind of excited to see that. And I want to see what's going on with Brian Goodwin because that guy is a favorite of mine, and it has been a rough season for him.
Yeah, he was a top 101 guy. He was a guy that, you know, if he would have taken that step forward, I mean, he could have really jumped into that tier, you know, of like impact potential talent. But yeah, it hasn't been pretty at times.
Man, I saw him in Arizona and I was like, ooh. Ooh, I was so excited.
Oh, you get it. Yeah, when you see it, you get it.
I mean, that bat speed is just, I mean, it is quick.
Yeah.
Quick hands and yeah.
Quick hands, good athlete.
Yeah, yeah. Good center field, great arm. Yeah, so.
He's a player. It's so, just, you know, he's got a lot of work to do to get there.
Yeah, so that's what I'm doing. So
good. We'll both be busy still, which is excellent.
Which is awesome. So, and then next week you come down to see me next weekend. So.
Yes, sir. Yeah, so. Actually, I'm not going to. It's about to kick off tomorrow. That I come back. I go to the New Britain series, and then like a couple of days later, I leave for the Nationals event. And then Jason Cole and I are going to go sit on a Salem series for 4 days, and then immediately we drive back up because that's the Futures game week. and we have activities every night. And then after that, I'm flying to St. Louis for the BP event. And then from St. Louis, I'm flying to the AZL for 10 days.
Oh, fuck.
And then when I get back, I'm in town for 2 days, and I fly to Cincinnati for the BP event. I fly home for 1 day, and then I fly to San Diego for a week for the showcase out there, the amateur showcase.
Oh, you're going for a PG All-American?
Yeah, the PG All-American in San Diego. So basically, like, I'm going to be home like 10 days out of the next 50. I can't fucking wait.
Nice.
This is great.
Nice. Nice. That'll be great. That'll
yeah, this
be
is awesome. This is the life, man.
All right. Well, enjoy your games. A pleasure as always. We'll do it again next week.
Thanks, Precious.
Intrepid Inspections, the sponsor of the podcast, bringing the same high-level thought and process to insurance inspections that Baseball Prospectus brings to baseball. Visit intrepidinspections.com for our BP subscriber special. Music from Slow Warm Depth takes you out of here. He's Jason. I'm Mike. We'll talk to you next week.